Good afternoon. On behalf of the DC Lawyers Chapter, welcome to our July luncheon. We're delighted to have such a large crowd on such a hot summer's day. It's a tradition in this chapter that in July we sponsor a roundup of the recently completed Supreme Court term. This year, we are particularly delighted and honored to have as our guest Miguel Estrada, who will share his analysis with us. Evidently, it is true what they say: immigrants will do the jobs that Americans won't. You might think it's difficult to sum up an entire term in a set of luncheon remarks, but Miguel is the man who, in oral argument, famously told the Supreme Court, "Just let me take a second to make 2 points." Now, we always like to have a little fun with percentages at these lunches. And Miguel began his experience in front of the Supreme Court the way that many do, as an assistant to the Solicitor General. Upon returning to private practice at Gibson, Dunn, and Crutcher, Miguel's had 5 more arguments and won 4 of them. That's all the more notable when you consider that his sole loss came in a death penalty case in which he was representing a convicted murderer, obviously a hard case. So his win rate in cases for more typical private sector clients is an astonishing 100%. Even more significantly, he's not lost a Supreme Court case in the last decade, and he won 3 of his cases 9-0. His recent win on behalf of Conrad Black in a case challenging the so-called Honest Services Fraud statute was notable for a number of reasons. The Supreme Court had denied cert in dozens of petitions over the 20-year history of the statute. Miguel not only persuaded the court to grant cert, but won the case unanimously, significantly limiting the statute's scope and thus the opportunity for government abuse. Now, across all of his cases, one justice has voted for Miguel every single time. Justice Kennedy, who just happens to be Miguel's old boss from the days when Miguel was clerking on the court. Justice Kennedy even voted in Miguel's favor in the murder case. Now, we all remember that wonderful letter from Larry Tribe to President Obama that Ed Whalen found somewhere. And in that letter, Professor Tribe predicted, you might recall, that a Justice Kagan would get a particularly good purchase on Tony Kennedy's mind. Miguel seems to have a good grip on something, but also he seems to have a solid understanding of Justice Kennedy's mind. To persuade the mind of Justice Kennedy, of course, requires that Miguel pursue his own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, of the mystery of human life, in pursuit of the liberty of the person in both its spatial and more transcendent dimensions. That Miguel can persuade Justice Kennedy and still write a simple declarative sentence says much about his legal talents. In addition to his Supreme Court work, Miguel also has an active practice in the appellate courts. Among many other representations, he serves as lead counsel for one of the networks in connection with the FCC's enforcement regime seeking to limit indecent broadcasts. I think it's fair to say Miguel is opposed to those limits. As we all know, Miguel was denied a seat on the DC Circuit for unworthy reasons and by unprecedented political maneuvers. We don't need to linger over that travesty, but it's appropriate to note that Justice Kagan has formally told the Senate that in her view, Miguel is qualified to serve on the Supreme Court. It's also worthy to note that just last year, a columnist for the New Republic, of all things, observed, quote, "Democrats opposed Estrada because they feared him." One left-wing commentator at the time opined, "When Estrada is not litigating on behalf of Republican candidates and large corporations, he is involved in right-wing circles, above all in connection with the Federalist Society in which he is an active member." Score 1 for the Society. But according to Wikipedia, the case against Miguel is more damning still. Quote, he was even known, to be a friend of Ann Coulter. You can hear the frisson of terror in the individual who wrote that entry. The New Republic guy was right. They really are afraid of Miguel. Fortunately, more rational minds have recognized Miguel's very great legal skills. In 2004, the Legal Times named Miguel one of the nation's top appellate litigators, noting that people who follow appellate practice in Washington have known for several years that Estrada is one of the best around. Washingtonian Magazine has named him one of the top constitutional lawyers, a, quote, power lawyer, one of the true rising stars of the legal profession, who could become one of the legends of the Supreme Court bar. In 2010, Chambers named him as one of a handful of attorneys ranked in the top tier among the nation's leading appellate lawyers, describing him as an unbelievably smart attorney with a creative approach to cases and a real fighting spirit. But what of the private Miguel? The man with the beloved Doberman, which he boasts is smarter than your honor student. The quiet counselor and considerate friend known best to his colleagues at Gibson Dunn. Rumor has it that Miguel was recently voted by the associates at Gibson Dunn to receive two prestigious awards. The award for the most cuddly lawyer named Miguel Estrada, and the award for the partner most likely to greet you with a fleeting expletive. Miguel graduated from Harvard Law School. He clerked for Judge Kearse on the Second Circuit and for Justice Kennedy. His public service includes not only his clerkships and his tour in the Solicitor General's office, but also several years as a prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York. His public service continues today as counsel for John Yoo in a case arising out of Professor Yoo's tenure in the Justice Department in connection with the War on Terror. He's a trustee of the Supreme Court Historical Society and a member of the Board of Visitors of the Harvard Law School, and we are delighted that he is with us today. Miguel.
Thank you, Doug, for that very kind intro. Some of that was even true, as often happens. Welcome all to the overview to the OT 2010 term. Thank you for being here. I'm glad that we have such a large crowd. Now, many of you probably know that Ted Olson, who usually headlines this little shindig, has a practice of starting out with a tribute to a particularly inexplicable, stupid, embarrassing, or otherwise incomprehensible act by a public figure. And we felt that it would be bad to break with that practice, so we thought that we might give it a crack. Now, the past highlights, of course, or you know, the lowlights, you know, depending on how you look at it, have included the Clintons. Sharon Stone inviting her barefoot husband into the cage of the Komodo dragon in the Los Angeles Zoo, and of course, the lately lamented former talking head at CNN, formerly known as client number 9. This year, once again, the competition was quite stiff, but we had to make several arbitrary judgments. I had no trouble cutting out some guy who thought that the very best idea of becoming a federal judge was to slander Judge Alito just as he was about to become Justice Alito. For that sort of stupidity, you do not get an award here or in the Senate. I have to say that I was intrigued by Charlie Sheen for a while. I thought he had promise. When we got to the Tiger Blood, I thought he was trying too hard and we disqualified him. Then we get to our silver medal for today, which is none other than the gift that keeps on giving, Uncle Joe. The Vice President of the United States, you may recall, has given us such gems in the past as urging a man confined in a wheelchair to stand up, Chuck, people can't see you. And also urging, you know, the rest of us to concentrate on that three-letter word, jobs, J-O-B-S, jobs. This year, he did not disappoint. At the gathering on St. Patrick's Day for the Prime Minister of Ireland, he welcomed the Prime Minister by noting that the Prime Minister's mother lived in the United States for many years, and then asked for the blessing of all those in attendance for her late memory, saying, God rest her soul. Lovely sentiment, except she's very much alive. This brought to my mind that little snippet in the 2008 campaign when Terry McAuliffe said to the late Tim Russert that his dad, Tim's, was likely watching them from heaven, to which the late Mr. Russert promptly replied, he's actually watching from his Barca lounger. Now, if the most suspicious prone among you see some sort of pattern among high-profile Democrats to put our parents speedily in the grave before their time, I am sure Obamacare will set your mind at ease. Now, by now you probably have figured out that this year's winner can be none other than former Congressman Anthony Weiner. I have to say that it is harder than you might think, because he was a zero as a congressman, and despite his many efforts to get his mug on cable television, no one other than Rachel Maddow actually gave a damn what he thought. But, you know, the sheer artistry of the PR strategy really won him the medal this year. Just to briefly recap, you may recall that his first claim was that his Twitter account had been hacked. He then said that he wasn't sure whether it was pictures of his private parts or not. Now, this is a PR strategy that only works for those of you whose private parts are so well known online that you cannot plausibly deny ownership. Once he admitted that the pictures might just be of him, he hastened to add that he didn't take the pictures, because everybody knows that everybody's mind will be set at ease just as soon as you explain that there was somebody in the room with you. And so one could go on, but, and I hesitate to say this, it's really low-hanging fruit. And so without further ado, I think we congratulate former Congressman Weiner on his win this year. We wish him best on cable television. I am sure we will all be tuning in to Cinemax after 10. Now, having that ritual of this shindig out of the way, let me turn to a little bit of the term overview. This year I have the very unenviable task of having to summarize for you one of the most boring terms in decades. Doug beat me to the punch and actually stole one of my lines. I'm sure he got into my computer files when he pointed out that he had such trouble finding somebody to do this that he ultimately settled on the Hispanic. So this really must be one of those jobs that nobody else will do. In fact, you know, the term was so boring that Justice Ginsburg finally persuaded a majority of her colleagues to fall asleep with her on the bench. Now, if you get your news from the New York Times, though I'm guessing that's not very likely here, you probably think that instead of napping, the justices spend the entire year at each other's throats with a cabal of five fascists trying to undermine the careful work of the framers, by which the Times, of course, means Earl Warren, Bill Brennan, and Harry Blackmun. If only. You know, the numbers confirm that the whole thing was a snooze fest. You don't have to trust me on this. You can look them up on Tom Goldstein's website, and he's an ECS guy. You may have to check his math, though. So, you know, the Colt stats are that the Colt got 75 merits opinions and 5 summary reversals for the year. 38 of those were either 9-0 or 8-0, which means almost 48% unanimity. An additional 10 were either 8-1 or 7-1, which is an extra 12.5%. So in 60% of the cases, the justices couldn't even find anything to argue about. Now, in addition, we had an additional 15% that were either 7-2 or 6-2. So that gets us up to 75%. And it's only about 16 cases, which works out to about one-fifth, which were 5-4 or 5-3. That's pretty small. Now, if you take all 80 cases, the Supreme Court overturned the lower court in 79% of the cases. This might make you think that the one thing in which they all agree is that the quality of justice in the lower courts is really pretty bad. Since I'm an appellate lawyer, I wouldn't say anything as dumb as that. Now, in terms of the sheer number of the reversals, the Ninth Circuit, our beloved favorite, once again, led the pack with 19, although it did get affirmed 7 times, including twice by an equally divided court. As a percentage of the cases, the Sixth Circuit led the way, if you want to put it that way, maybe trailed the pack, being overturned in 86% of the Sixth Circuit cases that the Supreme Court heard. So if you have recently won a very large victory in the Sixth Circuit, maybe you should not take it to the bank just yet. I'm talking to you, Kathleen. Now, it was Kagan's first term in the court. All told, she sat out of 26 out of the 80 cases in which the court issues an opinion. So she was working about two-thirds. That will get fixed over time because we can infer that most of her recusals stemmed from her prior work as Solicitor General. Now, each of her majority opinions got at least 7 votes. From that, you might infer that Tribe was right, that she has a keen purchase on the mind of the rest of the court. She's able to persuade others to her point of view, or maybe it just means that the rookie justice gets hazed with really the crappy cases. In 94% of the cases, Justice Kagan agreed in full, in part, or in the judgment with Justice Sotomayor, President Obama's other Supreme Court appointee. That was the second highest level of agreement among two justices. The only two other justices who had a higher level of agreement were President George W. Bush's two appointments, Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito, who agreed 96.2% of the time. Again, maybe that tells you that the White House is getting better and better at picking justices who follow their ideological views, or maybe it just means that as the justices get old and crotchety, they get more and more wedded to the views they have previously expressed, and they're very unlikely to be persuaded by new justices, even those from the same party. You decide. Now, the agreement between the justices can also be measured by those cases in which they agreed in full. And on that level, Justice Kagan and Justice Ginsburg had the highest level of agreement at 84.6%. Now, I did promise you some really boring cases, and I guess I really can't avoid this, but I'm going to try to run through a sample really quickly. Not that I don't actually think that I should not put you through the whole torture, but I don't think even this hotel has enough coffee. So let me just tick off a few. U.S. versus Tohono O'odham Nation dealt with the weighty question of whether 28 U.S.C. Section 1500 precludes the Court of Federal Claims from exercising jurisdiction over a suit if the plaintiffs have a second action against the United States already pending before another court that is, quote-unquote, based on substantially the same operative facts, unquote. Milner versus Department of the Navy dealt with the weighty question whether certain data and maps qualify for withholding under FOIA Exception 2. Cigna versus Amara dealt with the weighty question whether Section 502A1B of ERISA, which authorizes a plan participant or beneficiary to bring a civil action to recover benefits due, yada, 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 means that you have to follow the summary plan description. And in Staub versus Proctor Hospital, they'll be teaching this in law school anytime, the court held that under the Uniformed Services Employment and Reemployment Rights Act of 1994, an employer is liable if, quote, a supervisor performs an act motivated by anti-military animus that is intended by the supervisor to cause an adverse employment action, and if that act is approximate cause of the ultimate employment action. There were other cases of similar ilk. Chase Bank, I'm sure this will hit you close to home, held that when a creditor increases the periodic rate on a credit card account in response to a cardholder default, pursuant to a default term that was disclosed in the contract governing the account, 12 CFR section 226.9C does not require that the creditor give the cardholder a change in terms notice. Are you awake still? Astra versus, I won't keep doing this to you. I think you get the idea. So let's see what we can do that we can talk about that might cause you not to shoot me. So let's start on that line of hope, with the First Amendment cases. Now, the court had four of those this term. I will start with the very disturbing case of Snyder versus Phelps. You may have heard about this case. There is some so-called Reverend Phelps in his Westboro Baptist Church who, after waddling out of the shallow end of the gene pool, have nothing better to do than to show up at the funerals of servicemen who have fallen in the light of duty, holding signs saying charming things like, thank God for dead soldiers and you're going to hell. One of the families of one such soldier successfully sued this crowd for intentional infliction of emotional distress, but in an opinion for eight justices, the Chief Justice concluded that such a claim was barred by the First Amendment. Chief Justice Roberts reasoned that the protest involved matters of public concern and thus could not be made the subject of this suit. The Onion, which you may have read, attempted to satirize this outcome with a headline, quote, disgusted Supreme Court can't believe it has to rule that having sex with an American flag is protected by the First Amendment. The parody actually falls somewhat flat. It's like when SNL tried to do a parody of Lady Gaga. If the lady already wears steak, there's nothing you can really do to really drive the point home. And so with this crowd, Justice Alito was the only justice who dissented. He emphasized that the church, if you want to call it that, had many other outlets for expressing its views, and as he put it, quote, in order to have a society in which public issues can be openly and vigorously debated, it is not necessary to allow the brutalization of all innocent victims, unquote. Now, the next big First Amendment argument is Sorrell versus IMS Health. Now, as you probably know, or can figure out if you think about it, pharmacies have a lot of information about what sort of drugs doctors do and do not give their patients. And so Vermont passed a law saying that pharmacies were not allowed to sell that sort of what doctors do what information to pharmaceutical companies, which might then use it to refine their pitch to the doctors. But under the law, pharmacies were allowed to sell the data for other purposes, such as health reform and whatnot. The court, by a 6-3 vote, invalidated that law in an opinion by Justice Kennedy. He applied what he called heightened scrutiny without specifying whether it was strict or intermediate, and he found that the law was both a content and a speaker-based law. There were three dissenters, Justice Breyer, Justice Kagan, and Justice Ginsburg. Interestingly, there were many cites in the dissent to the dissenting opinion of Chief Justice Rehnquist in the Central Hudson case many years ago, which does make you wonder whether there are actually three justices on the Supreme Court who want to go to the days in which truthful commercial speech had virtually no constitutional protection. Something to think about. Now, in the third case, which I'm sure you've heard about, Brown versus Entertainment Merchants, the court invalidated a California law that made it unlawful to send to sell violent video games to children under 18 without the consent of the parents. That vote on a large scale was 7-2, but it was split in two different opinions. Writing for five, and Justice Kennedy, Justice Ginsburg, Justice Kagan, and Justice Sotomayor, Justice Scalia concluded that video games are a fully protected form of First Amendment expression. With his usual flair, he also pointed out to the violence and gore in all the great classics of literature, such as Homer and the Cyclops, you know, the Grimm's fairy tales, which, as he said, were grim indeed. And of course, that little vignette of from Dante's Inferno of the politicians suffering in a lake of boiling pitch while listening to a speech by Nancy Pelosi. Justice Alito, joined by the Chief Justice, did not join those five justices, but voted to invalidate the law on the ground that the terms used in the statute were too vague. Justice Thomas and Justice Breyer both dissented, but their reasons could not be more different. For Justice Thomas, an examination of the 16th and 17th century law led him to conclude that children have no First Amendment rights. Justice Breyer focused on the sociology of the 21st century to conclude that with this sort of changing technology, maybe this sort of laws could be passed. So if there are anybody, if there's anybody here in the TV business, maybe you can think of a odd couple cop show where, you know, the grandson of sharecroppers teams up with an effete Francophile to use the techniques of the 17th century and the 21st century to solve crimes as mysteries. There are worse things on television. Now, the final case that I think is worth mentioning, you probably have also heard of. It's called Arizona Free Enterprise Club versus Bennett. Now, the issue here was an Arizona campaign law that gave additional matching campaign funds to publicly funded candidates whenever the privately financed opponent of that candidate or even independent groups spent money on the other side. Now, speaking for the 5-4 majority, the Chief Justice concluded that the result in the case was obvious based on an earlier case called Davis versus FEC, a 2008 case where the court had invalidated a rule that simply relaxed the contribution limits for candidates whose opponents had spent too much. If merely lifting the contribution limits for my opponents when I engage in campaign speech is a violation of the First Amendment, the court reasoned, surely it is even worse to just hand over the taxpayer cash. Now, of course, the fact that the case was fairly easy based on established case law did not keep Justices Kagan, Ginsburg, Breyer, and Sotomayor from bitterly dissenting. And as night follows day, the New York Times attacked the decision by showing once again that the court was engaged in an evil errand, beginning with the Citizens United case, and by pillaging the court for allowing people who owned corporations, maybe even foreigners, to have a voice in public affairs. Now, of course, as you may realize, the New York Times is a corporation that is engaged in nothing other than trying to influence public affairs, and which from time to time needs to be bailed out by a fellow by the name of Carlos Slim, who is a Mexican billionaire and the richest man in the world. To borrow a phrase from Justice Kagan's dissent in the case, one could call that chutzpah. Now, to recap on the First Amendment cases, the only threat in the term appears to be that Justice Kennedy and Justice Scalia joined the most speech-friendly decisions. And in fact, if you look at the longer term, Justice Kennedy, year in and year out, manages to cobble together different groups of Supreme Court justices to reach the most favorable outcome to free speech. On the other hand of the balance here, Justice Breyer voted in favor of the First Amendment only once this term, and even then he wrote a separate opinion adding some caveats. If you want to take even a longer view of how the court has been doing with the First Amendment, you could conclude, I'm not saying you should, but you could conclude that a lopsided majority of the court is ready to find the First Amendment in cases involving sex, nude dancing, violence, desecrating funerals, and stomping on little animals. But it is very unlikely or close to unlikely to find the First Amendment in cases involving campaign speech about how we govern ourselves. If you find this prospect somewhat depressing, the bar is down the hall. Now, let me switch gears and talk a little bit about the business cases from the term. Gene, can we get more coffee? The Senate Judiciary Committee, as you may have heard, in the form of Patrick Leahy, recently held hearings in which he labeled the current court, quote, the most business-friendly Supreme Court in the last 75 years, unquote. Slate's Dahlia Lithwick went considerably further when she complained that the Roberts Court has proven to be Christmas in July for big business. And it is true that businesses did achieve some major victories, though, of course, as always the case with such assessments, you know, the picture was considerably more mixed. I think the biggest win in the term for business was probably Walmart versus Duke's, which involved a class action which sought to aggregate 1.5 million women who work for Walmart all over the country. The class had been certified at the district court, and the certification had been affirmed by the Ninth Circuit en banc by a vote of 6-5, despite Judge Kaczynski's complaint that the plaintiffs in the case had nothing in common other than their sex and this lawsuit. When the case got to the Supreme Court, the court unanimously reversed the class in an opinion by Justice Scalia. Now, there were two holdings in this case. The first one was 9-0. The court concluded that it was unlawful to assemble these diverse plaintiffs who had suffered multiple employment experiences in different areas of the country in the same nationwide class under Section 23B2, which is the non-opt-out part of the class action rule. As I said, there was not a single member of the court who thought that the Ninth Circuit en banc had been right in assembling this class under Rule 23B2. A second and narrower majority of the court, led again by Justice Scalia and what is popularly considered the four other conservatives, further concluded that this could not be any type of class under Rule 23A because there was not enough commonality among the experiences of the members of the class. Justice Ginsburg and the other three justices dissented from that view. Naturally, when you read, you know, the news the next day and you turned to the beloved New York Times, you learned that the five conservatives had just made it impossible for women to sue for civil rights violations, and describing Justice Ginsburg's opinion on one part of the case as the opinion for, quote, the four moderates. I can give you no better summary of the bias and insularity of the New York Times. Now, the next good victory, big victory for business, is a case called AT&T Mobility LLC versus Concepcion. Now, the issue here is whether if you enter into an arbitration agreement with your phone provider or some other company, whether a purported waiver of class arbitration in that agreement is enforceable. The Ninth Circuit had concluded that under California law, and in particular the law of unconscionability, that part of the arbitration agreement was not enforceable. And so if you entered into that sort of consumer agreement and it directed you to arbitration, you would disregard any notion in the agreement that you could not have class arbitration. The Supreme Court, in an opinion by Justice Scalia once again, concluded that such an application of the California law of unconscionability was preempted by the FAA, and that therefore the agreement had to be enforced as it had been written. There were four dissents. Justice Breyer, in his dissent, asked, quote, what rational lawyer would have signed on to represent the Concepcions in litigation for the possibility of fees stemming from a $32.22 claim, unquote. He ought not to worry because that towering statesman, Senator Al Franken, has already introduced a statute trying to overturn the outcome. Now, the last major victory for business is a securities case called Janus Capital Group versus First Derivative Traders. Now, in that case, once again, 5-4, the court held that somebody cannot be held liable in a private suit for statements he did not make. That's the holding. I can't make it up. And so, this was largely an application of the court's earlier rulings in the Central Bank case and the Stone Ridge case, though once again, the fact that the case was clearly, ineluctably, unarguably controlled by existing case law did not keep four people from filing a bitter dissent. Before turning to the other side of the logic of the ledger, I should briefly mention a case that had some news. It's called American Electric Power Company versus Connecticut, which deals with the cottage industry of, how should I call this politely? Well, it deals with the environment. And so the issue really is the use of litigation to try to stem greenhouse gases that people in this room have long been predicting will someday kill us all, but not in the same sense. The issue was whether once the court ruled some years ago that the Clean Air Act will allow you to regulate carbon dioxide as a pollutant, whether you can also have a federal common law cause of action to sue for the same thing. The court held no, you cannot. You cannot imply a federal common law cause of action that is in keeping with the court's practice for the last several decades of not recognizing the implication of new federal common law causes of action is actually no big news. Now, the court did not deal with any of the hard issues, such as the standing of the plaintiffs, on which the court split 4-4, or the more interesting issue whether the federal statute as construed by the Supreme Court will be meant to preempt state causes of action for the same thing. Now, on the other side of the ledger, I will mention quickly one of the cases where, although you may have not have seen it in the news, you know, the business community lost. Now, the big one here is a case called Chamber of Commerce versus Whiting, in which the court took the radical step of actually affirming the Ninth Circuit in a case involving an Arizona statute that took away the business license of businesses that hired illegal aliens. Now, in that case, the folks who were voting against the Chamber of Commerce were the justices that the popular press styles of the conservatives. All of the liberals sided with the Chamber of Commerce. In Matrix Initiatives versus Siracusano, the court unanimously rejected a bright line rule that the failure to disclose reports of adverse effects of a drug was immaterial if there were no statistical significance to the results. There was a case called Smith versus Bayer that dealt with the intricacies of the Anti-Injunction Act. I think all I need to tell you about that was that in announcing her opinion for the court, Justice Kagan started out by saying, you may need a law degree and a cup of coffee. And in Erica P. John Fund Inc. versus Halliburton, once again the court ruled against the business community in a class action case, in holding that a plaintiff need not prove loss causation at the class cert stage. There are other cases in which, of course, business lost. You may be thinking by now, well, of course, I should have lost many of those cases. But this one is interesting. It's called Kasten versus Saint Gobain, where Justice Breyer, for a six-member majority, held that one files a complaint under the Fair Labor Standards Act, where you simply orally tell your employer that you have a complaint. We don't know how this will apply to court filings, and the guy who happens to be homeless and yells at the judges of the district court here may owe a lot in filing fees. Try to finish up on the business cases. Once again, the court took a whole number of patent cases. I'm sure you want to hear them in detail. I will mention only one. In Microsoft versus I4I, the court held in an 8-0 decision that a party seeking to establish the invalidity of the patent must do so by clear and convincing evidence rather than merely by preponderance. There were a couple of cases involving the weighty issue of personal jurisdiction. One of them was unanimous and the other one was incomprehensible. The only interesting one was the latter, which is called McIntyre versus Nicastro, in which the court, after noted that these weighty questions had been left open for decades and were left open when the court split multiple ways in a case called Asahi in 1987, once again gave us an answer that was 4-2-3. And so this is good news for those of you in the room who charge by the hour. Now, let me get out of the business cases and say a little bit about law enforcement. Now, the court usually has a whole slew of cases dealing with, you know, the criminal law, the Constitution, and statutes every year. I will mention, you know, the highlights first, starting with the constitutional cases. In a case called JDB versus North Carolina, the court held that for purposes of the Miranda rule, the age of a child is relevant to ascertaining whether the child is in custody while being subject to questioning. In Kentucky versus King, the court dealt with the exigent circumstances doctrine under the Fourth Amendment, and you will be shocked to learn that if you're a properly authorized cop and you loudly knock on somebody's door, as the Supreme Court has told you, you have to before you try to enter, and lo and behold, the toilets start flushing and things start going out the window, you may go in without a warrant. And the court thought that that was exigent circumstances, turning down the argument for, let's call him the householder, that this was a manufactured emergency. Now, the court had two interesting cases under the Confrontation Clause. For those of you who haven't had coffee in the last 10 minutes, that's the part of the Constitution that says that in criminal cases, you actually have a right to see your accusers in court, and you actually also have a right to go in and ask them questions. And so the first of those cases was Michigan versus Bryant, which involved an entrepreneur who was shot by one of his business partners, managed to hobble away multiple blocks, and finally land in a gas station where he proceeded to bleed to death. Before he met his maker, somebody actually called the cops, who showed up in mass and interrogated him in detail as to what had happened, who did it, give me more details, etc. And so the issue in the case was whether the statements made by the now dead business associate of the perp could come into evidence under the Confrontation Clause. Now, I should start out by thinking that if this sounds to you like a textbook example of the dying declarations exception to the hearsay doctrine, it sounded that way to me too and to the justices, except that the state of Michigan, in its infinite wisdom, never argued that below. And so the court was confronted with a case in which there was not even a fig leaf for the admission of something that seemed to all of them to be pretty good evidence. And the casualty in the case turned out to be the Confrontation Clause. You may recall that some years ago in a case called Crawford, the Supreme Court announced in a unanimous opinion by Justice Scalia that they were out of the business of trying to finagle with the confrontation clause on the basis of the presumed reliability of the declarant. And in doing so, the court expressly overruled a line of cases which sort of exemplified that approach, and that were led by a case called Ohio versus Roberts. Now, I'm sure I'm not giving anything away when I tell you that the court came out very strongly on the side of the proposition that the dead guy's statements could be admitted into evidence. But the opinion by Justice Sotomayor, without never quite getting around to explaining how this was different from Ohio versus Roberts, you know, the case that was just overruled, concluded that this was reliable enough for government work. There were only two dissents in the case. Justice Scalia, the author of the Crawford opinion, he was joined by Justice Ginsburg. It is an interesting question in light of this case whether the Crawford line of cases will be an aberration or whether we will be seeing the return of Ohio versus Roberts. As I always say, never count out the old chief, who was the author of that opinion. On the other side of the ledger, there is a case called Bull Cumming versus New Mexico, which deals with the question whether if you are busted with a substance that looks suspiciously white and is in a glassine envelope and in due course gets tested by a lab, when to no one's shock it comes out to be a controlled substance, whether when you are on trial for that offense the report of the chemist comes in without more, or whether you have to have the testimony of the chemist that actually perform the examination. And the court concluded that the confrontation clause requires the latter. This simply reaffirms what the court said in an opinion a couple of terms ago called Melendez-Diaz. Justice Kennedy, Justice Breyer, and Justice Alito continued not to agree with the Melendez-Diaz line of cases. Marching right along and trying to wrap up, we have a whole slew of cases involving habeas corpus. I could do again what I did earlier by trying to explain what each of them said, but I'll just say there were eight of them, and that the moral of the story is the warden always wins. And so I'll skip those and move straight to one of the interesting cases of the term, which is styled Brown versus Plata. In this case, the court affirmed a Ninth Circuit injunction, which said that, that as a result of overcrowding in the California prisons, it was an appropriate remedy to order the state of California to set loose a large number of inmates currently residing in such conditions, possibly as many as 40,000 of them. Justice Scalia wrote a bitter dissent in which he said that this was perhaps, you know, the worst injunction in the nature's history. According to the New York Times, as he read his dissent from the bench, quote, Justice Kennedy looked straight ahead at his colleague as his colleague spoke, and his face was frozen in a grim expression. So I don't know what to tell you about Brown. I think if you take it and the habeas cases together, the moral of the story may be that when the Ninth Circuit lets a prisoner out on habeas, it will inevitably get overturned, but letting them out wholesale is okay. Now, let me say one, just a couple of things about the statutory cases. There is a statute called the Armed Career Criminal Act. We get a few of those cases every term. You know, the basic sense of the statute is that if you are somebody who is an armed felon and previously has engaged in violent crimes, then your jail sentence should be longer. Now, the court, maybe I shouldn't say, what the heck. If Senator Leahy spent a lot more time writing statutes in English not holding bloviating hearings about the Supreme Court, maybe these cases wouldn't get into the Supreme Court. But the fact is that the court has been pulling its hair for several years over the meaning of the statute, leading Justice Scalia this term to finally announce he was ready to declare the last clause on the statute vague for vagueness. He followed that with a dissent from a number of cases on the same statute that were overturned for cert later in the term, where he said that the issues in these cases would be a fine subject for a law office betting pool. He also said that lower court judges will simply throw the opinions into the air in frustration and give free rein to their own feelings. They shouldn't do that because everybody knows that's the Supreme Court's job. I was going to mention, you know, the wacky fact pattern case of Bond, where the issue was whether if you find that your husband is having a child with your best friend, whether it is a good idea to go get dangerous chemicals and smear them everywhere where she might touch. The answer to that is no. And in addition, you may, however, become an advocate for federalism and urge to your heart's content that the federal government does not have power to deal with these sorts of crimes. There is, of course, you know, the fairly uninteresting case of Connick versus Thompson, which has a very sad story about a miscarriage of justice in which Brady evidence was withheld from somebody in a robbery case, which is very bad. Somehow, this Sterling citizen who had been found guilty of the robbery based on the Brady violation somehow then managed to get charged with a separate murder. He's very unlucky. Ultimately got convicted of that, but the Brady issue from the first case came to light, leading to the unraveling of the entire string of felonies and a new trial in which he was acquitted. He sued the New Orleans DA and got $14 million. Supreme Court said, no, you couldn't sue for the DA for failing to supervise the line lawyers over Brady. That's very bad news for the fellow who did spend many years in jail, but fortunately, he has a $6 million contract to make a movie about it. I should say, you know, there's the Jarndyce versus Jarndyce case, Stern versus Marshall, everybody's dead, and the issues about the bankruptcy, I don't actually think you want to hear about that. Flats versus Cohen is probably going to be sleeping with the fishes not too long from now. For those of you who recall, that's the case saying that you have taxpayer standing to sue over certain religion clause violations. It's a Warren Court special. In every case since then, you know, the court has done cartwheels not to follow it. We had one of these cases this term as well that was 5-4. There are a few interesting cases next term. They are, you know, the light at the end of the tunnel. There's a question having to do with the political question doctrine as to whether there can be a statute that directs the Secretary of State to recognize your place of birth as Israel if you were born in the city of Jerusalem. Then there is the case that Doug mentioned earlier, FCC versus Fox, is back in the Supreme Court. As he said, my client is NBC. The issue there is whether if you have a... If you have a starlet who utters certain expletives on live television, whether the appropriate answer is to find the network as opposed to the starlet. And the issue is now coming back, not on an EPA garb, but under the First Amendment, which was an issue that the court did not reach before. We may end up, of course, with other more interesting cases. It may be that the other statute from Arizona involving asking for identification of people who are suspected of illegal aliens, or maybe even Obamacare and gay marriage, will be here next term. You should stay tuned. You have been a more than indulgent audience, and I do thank you. I think they have coffee, and if not, as I mentioned earlier, I think the bar is over there. I am told by Jean that we have time for some questions. That does not mean we have to have them. Oh, there's somebody else. Yes?
Thank you. Very much enjoyed your discussion. Do you have thoughts, ideas, opinions, or anything you would care to say about the Obamacare legislation when it gets to the Supreme Court?
Well, you know, I can't say that I'm going to be the first person in the country, Congress included, that has actually read the thing. And so I have to be careful. I have looked at some of the papers, and it does appear to me that the government is engaged in two things. I mean, the first one is they are trying every trick they can so that the case will not get to the Supreme Court if it does, or be ruled upon before the 2012 election. And I think the political bet is that by hook or by crook, they will be reelected, and that then there will be sort of a feeling that this is done and this is the outcome of the democratic process, that the legislation has effectively been endorsed in a new election cycle. You know, the government had ample opportunities, as it has done in many other important cases in earlier years, once it lost the rulings in district courts, to file a notice of appeal in a regional court of appeals and to then seek cert before judgment. I have no doubt that, unlike the application of the Attorney General of the Commonwealth of Virginia, if the Obama administration had done that, then the court would have taken the case. But it is clear to me that they want to run out the clock in the regional courts of appeals. Once they get court of appeals rulings, they will try to eat up as much time as they can on the en banc process, and then they will have 90 days to seek cert. I will not be shocked if they seek extensions, which are also allowed. And I think, you know, the game seems likely to get kicked into a ruling by the court well after the 2012 election, which seems to me the primary motivation of the litigation strategy. Now, the second aspect of it is, you know, there are some things that are interesting about the litigation. I was mostly interested about the fact that the president, in a very famous video clip, adamantly denied that there were taxes in the legislation, even when challenged by some enterprising journalist with a dictionary in hand, and now the lead argument from the government to forestall the Commerce Clause challenges is that all of this is sort of irrelevant because didn't we tell you this is a tax? And so that's interesting to me. It gives me an insight into what they think their chances may be at the Supreme Court on the Commerce Clause and necessary and proper arguments. But as many of these cases show, I mean, it is very difficult to predict outcomes in the Supreme Court, because even cases that might seem to some people in this room to be clearly foreordained by existing case law turned out to be fairly contentious up there. So I think it would be dangerous to hazard a guess as to how it all turns out. Yes, Gene.
Yeah, I was curious. It seemed as though there were fewer of the sort of standard 5-4 splits this time around, and there were a lot more unusual pairings than usual. Is that correct, or is that just?
Well, I think, you know, the sample size, as I started out by saying, is so small. You had 16 cases out of 80, where there were 5-4 or 5-3, and because of the random, because of the randomness of the cases that get to the court, there were very few issues that might seem, even to a layperson, to implicate the type of conservative liberal splits that oftentimes turned out to bitterly divide the court. And so, I mean, I think that that may be right. It may be, I'm not sure that there's anything that we can draw from that, because of every year there is a new conclusion about the current Supreme Court that is based on the latest information. And the truth is that the sample size is always very small, and is beset by a lot of randomness. Are we done? Thank you all.
Miguel, thank you very much for being with us today. As you may know, we have a tradition this chapter of giving our guests a leather-bound copy of the Federalist Papers, and as you go forward and scale new heights, you can consult it and add even more erudition to your briefs. Thanks very much.
Thank you.